The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board.
Woo!
All right, we're back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find Midwest Swing on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We're part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Cold Omaha, which is now Zone Coverage, on Twitter at Zone Coverage MN. I am your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon _ Warren. We are coming at you here from the 105 The Vibe Studios. I have Tom Schreier, co-founder of Cold Omaha and Zone Coverage, behind the window here doing the production. Tom, what's going on? What's new in your world?
Not too much. I'm just excited about the site. We got a lot of good stuff up there today, and yeah, can't complain.
Yeah, working on some mock draft stuff. It's draft season. I know that we've got NFL free agency coming up here very quickly. I think they're in the legal tampering window here later today. Obviously going to be a very active season for the Vikings. We are also in the midst of spring training. Lots of stuff going on, people getting all wound up about the Twins losing 19-0 last week. I tell you this much, it does not matter. Spring training results do not matter, but it is fun to see, obviously, some guys that we're going to see not only now, but in the near future. Speaking of guys that we'll see in the future, we do have the play-by-play voice of the Rochester Red Wings, where most of the Twins minor leaguers come from or jump from to the minor to the big leagues. Josh Wetzel. Josh, how are we doing?
Good, guys. How you doing?
Not too bad.
I'm doing well.
And so, obviously, you are not in season yet. So, what is your spring preparation look like right around this time of year?
Well, I've been kind of, you know, going over who I think is maybe going to appear in Rochester and paying attention to what's happening there in spring training and just kind of in general getting an idea of maybe who's going to be here to start 2017. I've been trying to compile some notes on guys that I think possibly will be here and that sort of thing, and I also broadcast college basketball in the winter, so that's kind of winding down right now with the conference basketball tournament coming up. So I've got a lot of different things going on at the moment.
Yeah, you got the MAC tournament late this week and then into the weekend, right?
Yeah, the Mid-American Conference tournament for Buffalo, the team that I broadcast for, we'll start Thursday night, so we'll see what happens.
So how far is that from where you live? I mean, I don't know the area well enough to know how far you have to commute for games.
Yeah, Buffalo's about an hour, maybe a little bit longer than that from Rochester. And then the MAC tournament is in Cleveland every year at Quicken Loans Arena, which is a good venue. And Cleveland's like 3 hours from Buffalo, so it's not too bad.
So how much travel do you have to do? I mean, are you, you know, if they play 30 games, are you on the road for 15 of them? I mean, I'm sure that's obvious, but are you driving, you flying? Is it depend on the location?
Just depends. I mean, in MAC play, it's a lot of busing, although they have started to take some little charter flights to a few of those places. In the non-conference season, it's, you know, who knows? I mean, it kind of depends year to year where they go. But this year, for example, we played in the Great Alaska Shootout. So
nice.
In Anchorage, Alaska for a week with those guys. And
how long of a flight is that, though?
That was, well, you know what's funny is we connected through Minneapolis.
Oh, wow.
And then it was like a 6 or 7 hour flight, I think, from Minneapolis to Anchorage. It was not a fun flight, to say the least. Now, fortunately, it got broken up on the way back because we connected in Seattle and then went to Omaha and played Creighton on the back end of it, so it kind of broke it up a little bit anyway.
So who are some of the best players you've seen over the last couple of years doing that?
In MAC play?
Well, anywhere. I mean, even non-conference or tournament play.
Yeah,
even if you're just watching a game between the scenes, too, you know, if you saw maybe Gonzaga or something like that, you might see all kinds of teams. Who are some of the best players you've seen?
Yeah, a couple of years ago, Buffalo played Kentucky and Wisconsin in the same season, and oddly enough, actually led both of those teams at halftime, shockingly.
Wow.
But obviously, that Kentucky team was absolutely loaded. That's a team that went undefeated most of the year, and actually until Wisconsin beat them. And then Wisconsin was loaded also. Those are two Final Four teams, so those two teams obviously stick out a lot as far as talented teams. And then Buffalo played at Iowa State last year. Iowa State was really good. Creighton was really good this year when Buffalo played them.
Right,
Watson got hurt, and that kind of threw a wrench into their season a little bit.
So you probably got to see guys like, was Nigel Hayes around with Wisconsin, or was that
Frank Kaminsky was the star player.
Well, yeah, obviously he was a big deal.
Yeah, Sam Decker and Frank Kaminsky were the two big guns on that team. And then the Kentucky team was just, you know, loaded. They had
That's a pick 'em.
All those guys.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. How do you enjoy that compared to doing baseball? Is it just a nice change of pace, or do you have a preference, or is it just kind of how you stay busy in the winter?
And I think a lot of play-by-play guys would tell you that they enjoy whatever sport is in season. I'm not going to tell you that. I mean, baseball's my favorite sport, and it's my favorite sport to broadcast. I really enjoy basketball, don't get me wrong, but mm-hmm. baseball is easily my favorite to do. Basketball is – and one of the things I enjoy about whether it's basketball, baseball, whatever, is the preparation part of it. And in basketball – you can prepare a ton of stuff and just never get a chance to even use very much of it.
Oh, I suppose it's game flow specific sometimes, too.
Yeah, and, you know, I've told people before, honestly, I think a lot of times if I just I could show up before a basketball game, like 30 minutes before the tip-off, and just get a couple of rosters and a stat sheet, and most people listening would have no idea that I had not prepared whatsoever for the broadcast.
Wow.
And just kind of fake my way through it a little bit. Obviously, in baseball, you can't really do that. But basketball is a lot of fun, and these conference tournaments are a blast, and we've already kind of gotten a taste of that the last few nights with some of these exciting conference tournaments around the country. So hopefully Buffalo will do well again this year. If they win the MAC tournament, they'll be the first team ever in the history of that conference to win the MAC tournament 3 straight years. So they're trying to make some history this season.
Yeah, I think I heard they're a number 3 seed. Is that accurate?
Yeah, they're the 3 seed, but they'll have as good a chance to win it as anybody, and they probably have the toughest draw of anybody in that conference tournament. But if they play their best, I think they'll do well.
So, does it help you keep sharp as far as your broadcasting chops, or is that not really a thing?
No, I think it does, actually. I think it does help, because once the baseball season rolls around and you get behind the microphone again during off seasons where I had not broadcast any games, you get back on the air and it's kind of funny. It doesn't feel as foreign to me this way, because I'll pretty much be broadcasting some sort of sport right up until the start of baseball season. So that is good. And, you know, Buffalo, actually, come to think of it, guys, has a Minnesota kid on the team, although he's redshirting this year, but Brock Bertram.
Oh, I recognize the name. Yeah, I recognize him for sure.
Yeah, he was from that, I think, Apple Valley, right? The team that was loaded with guys.
Yeah, they had Tyus Jones and Trey Jones and Gary Trent Jr.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Brock Bertram was on that team, and he's a freshman at UB. He's going to redshirt this year, but they have pretty high hopes for him down the road.
Yeah, how do you land a Minnesota kid in Buffalo? That's, you know, guys go Duke. I mean, obviously Duke is tough to compete with, but something must stand out in terms of family history or something that gets you to go to Buffalo.
And I'm not sure how they – I mean, they get guys from all over. I don't know. I mean, if you're a mid-major basketball coach, you've got to be pretty creative with with where you recruit from and where you land people from. And at the time that Brock was recruited to UB, Donyell Marshall was one of the assistant coaches.
That's a pretty good recruiting tool.
Right. You know, a former Timberwolf, for a matter of fact.
Right,
yeah. A great college player and a long NBA career. Donyell, I think, was really involved in Brock's recruiting. Now, since then, Donyell got a head coaching job at Central Connecticut State, so he's not around anymore, but Brock is there, and again, hopefully will be a big part of their future.
So let's roll it back a little bit.
Okay.
As far as your upbringing, you know, where did you grow up, and you know, what got you into baseball to start with?
Well, I grew up in Parsons, Kansas, which is a little town in southeast Kansas, about 10,000 people. And I actually grew up out in the country outside of town on a gravel road. But baseball was extremely extremely big in my family. My dad and his brothers were huge baseball fans, and were specifically big Dodgers fans, believe it or not. My uncle actually played a little bit in the Dodgers minor league system for a while. And they had started rooting for the Dodgers when they were kids to irritate their dad, who was a huge Cardinals fan.
Yeah, that would do
it. Yeah, and of course at that time the Cardinals were really good. The Dodgers were one of their main competitors in the National League, and so just to kind of get under their dad's skin, they started rooting for the Dodgers, and they stuck with it. It became like a lifelong fandom type of thing. So I grew up a big Dodgers fan, and you know, at that time it was a lot more difficult to obviously get broadcasts of any game you wanted. So, but I subscribed to like a Dodger magazine, and at one point in time, my dad actually bought one of those big satellite dishes that you could pull in signals from around the world with, and we would, you know, watch the 40 or 50 or 60 Dodgers games that they broadcast on TV at that point. And we were just big Dodgers fans, and I was pretty obsessed with it. I mean, in this day and age, if I would have had access to the internet and MLB.com and the ability to watch all these games, I don't know that I ever would have left the house, you know, as avid of a fan as I was. But that's kind of how it all started, as a big baseball fan, and you know, that was kind of what planted the seed.
Did you play?
Yeah, I played growing up and through high school. You know, I was not great or anything, just okay. But yeah, I loved to play, but I realized probably high school was going to be about the end of my athletic exploits.
So I saw you met Vin Scully, Nate Rowan, yeah. your PR director, your kind of jack of all trades for Rochester based on how minor league baseball works. I saw a picture that you met Vin Scully. Did he have any influence on your career path?
Well, I you know, obviously being a Dodgers fan and being somebody who was interested in broadcasting, Vin Scully was a huge idol of mine, so to speak. But I don't know if influence is a way to put it, because you can't really copy Vin Scully in any way, shape, or form, because you sound ridiculous if you try to copy what Vin Scully does. But the way I wound up meeting him is when I was a senior in high school, actually right before my senior year, I got diagnosed with cancer. I had cancer in my chest and wound up undergoing chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, you name it. And when I was, I guess in the spring of my senior year of high school, some classmates of mine organized a trip to Los Angeles to watch a Dodgers game, basically through an organization called the Dream Factory, which is kind of like Make-A-Wish Foundation. And it was during that trip to L.A. that I met Vin Scully, got my picture with him, and that sort of thing. And when I got back from that trip, the local little radio station in my hometown wanted to interview me about the trip. And so I went on this radio program, and it was hosted by a friend of mine who I had helped keep stats for on the local high school games and that sort of thing. And so he interviewed me on this this little community relations radio program, basically. And after the interview was over with, the station manager told me, he said, "Hey, Josh, you know, I really thought you did a nice job on the air, handled yourself well." He said, we've got a part-time opening at the radio station on the weekend. If you'd be interested in something like that, we'd love for you to apply. So I jumped at it, and he had me come out the next day and read a fake news report into a tape recorder as kind of an audition, and they wound up hiring me. So I wound up working on the weekends at the radio station in my hometown when I was, you know, 18 years old or whatever, as a board operator for Royals games or Kansas Jayhawk games and DJing and that sort of thing. And that's kind of how I actually started the broadcasting into the career. And then obviously, fortunately, everything turned out well as far as the cancer end of things were concerned also, because the treatments and the surgeries worked out and everything got taken care of.
Did you have any inkling that you had talent in that respect, you know, coming into going on the radio that time?
Oh, not necessarily. I'd never done anything on the air. I mean, I knew I was interested and I probably was looking toward pursuing that in college. I just didn't know how I would get started. And I was kind of a person that didn't really try things that were uncomfortable to me.
Sure.
And was a little bit timid in that regard. But when the opportunity was kind of presented to me and kind of fell in my lap, it was easy to say yes. So, but I didn't really know if I'd be any good at it or not, to be honest. I'd been around it a lot, you know, because my sophomore and junior years in high school, I pretty much was around the local radio play-by-play guy every high school basketball and football game, keeping stats for him. So I was around it a lot, and I always paid attention to it, but I'd never tried it, so I really didn't have any idea.
So I had read a story that you were the Ballpark Digest 2015 Broadcaster of the Year, which is pretty awesome. I had read in that you had the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So if I may ask, you know, how did you find out you had cancer? I mean, that's got to be kind of jarring as someone who's in high school.
Yeah.
You know, you're already going through a lot thinking about graduation and growing up and all that stuff. That's going to be a pretty interesting wrinkle to have there as well.
Yeah, it's one of those things that just kind of pops up when you least expect it. And that summer before my senior year of high school, I was having, I guess, some breathing problems and coughing a lot, and it got to the point where they decided I'd better have a chest X-ray, see what was going on. Not expecting anything like this, but once they took the chest X-ray, they saw something abnormal. And so they did another test, and that's when they discovered it. And so that kind of set everything into motion, and it was kind of a whirlwind there for a year and a half or so of a lot of different things going on in my life that weren't very fun. But everything got taken care of, as I mentioned. I mean, it was a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, I ultimately had my right lung removed completely.
Oh,
so
wow.
I think I'm, like I like to say, I'm probably the only play-by-play announcer out there with one lung. But, you know, at this point, everything has turned out pretty well, and this is a lot of years later. So in many regards, I was pretty lucky there.
So you obviously had the radio job towards the end of high school. What was the next step for you in that career? I suspect college and that kind of thing. But what was the next step you took as far as doing radio in school or anything like that after high school?
So I went to the junior college, my hometown, for a couple of years out of high school because I was part of that. My freshman year in junior college, I was still getting treatment, so I had to kind of stick around for that. And then my junior year, I transferred to the University of Kansas and got involved in the college radio station there doing various things. But because of the fact that I had some commercial radio station experience already, that kind of gave me an advantage over some of the other kids in the program. And I got hired at the local radio station to occasionally fill in doing sports updates and do some high school games, and I also was essentially the number two radio guy for the University of Kansas baseball team. So I had a chance to put some pretty good stuff on tape from there, and then once I graduated, I got a job in Liberal, Kansas, where they have one of these summer league teams.
Yeah, I have to be honest, that the name of that team always cracks me up. I know it shouldn't. I know it shouldn't, but Liberal BJs makes me giggle every time. Okay, that's the classic Tom Schreier laugh. I don't know if you can hear it.
I heard it.
It makes me giggle every single time. I know it makes me like a 12-year-old. I'm sorry to interrupt you with that, but it just kills me every time I see it.
I think it does everybody.
Yeah.
But and that the BJ's name came from Ban Johnson, by the way.
Oh, the former American League president, right?
Yeah, there was an old league called the Ban Johnson League, and that's where they got their name from. But that was a really good. The Jayhawk League back then was probably the third best of those summer college leagues behind the Cape Cod League and the Alaska League. Now I don't know if it's quite as strong as it was then, but they had a lot of good teams, and you basically traveled around almost like you were a minor league team. And doing their games that summer, I did probably, I don't know, 40 or 50 games, something like that, almost like a short season minor league season. And from that tape, I was able to land my first job in minor league baseball.
So I want to put a date on you or anything to date you too much, but like, who were some of the great Kansas athletes when you were there?
When I was there, in the football team, they had Dana Stubblefield.
Oh, yeah, he played for the 49ers, the defensive lineman.
Yep. Excuse me. So those were the two big guys in the football. Kwame Lassiter also had a nice NFL career.
With the Bills, I think? Where did he play?
Arizona Cardinals.
That's right.
In fact, he had I don't know if he still has the record or not, but he had the record for most interceptions in one game. I think he had three interceptions in one NFL game at one point.
Wow.
But on the basketball team, there were guys like Rex Walters, Jock Vaughn, Greg Ostertag.
Oh, yeah, I definitely remember Jock Vaughn. Can't forget Ostertag for sure.
Yeah, Ostertag actually lived across the hall from me my junior year. Those were probably the biggest names. Adonis Jordan was a good player. Those were maybe the biggest names at that point. They had really good teams when I was there, and they were number one part of that time. Didn't have as many guys outside of Jock Vaughn and Ostertag that had long NBA careers, though.
So you get out of college, you get that first job. You know, where did you start after doing the stuff with the BJs?
Yeah, so the Liberal job was my first full-time job out of school, and I worked at a radio station there at the same time doing that. And then I landed a job in Albany, Georgia, doing Albany Polecats baseball in the Class A South Atlantic League.
That's a Sally, right?
The Sally League, yeah. Yep. And they were a Montreal Expos affiliate. It was the last year the Polecats were around. And they were absolutely loaded. It was a team that featured Vlad Guerrero, Brad Fulmer. They had something like, I want to say 13 or 14 guys off that one team eventually played in the major leagues, which is a ridiculous number of guys from a low-A team. And yet they finished about 20 games under 500, believe it or not, because they were probably the youngest team in the league. They had terrible defense.
Was it 1995?
95. Aram Bocachica, who had a nice career, too. Bocachica was the shortstop, and he committed something like 56 errors and missed a month. Their defense was terrible.
Javier Vasquez.
Yeah, he was on that team for about half the season.
Mike Thurman, Jeremy Powell, Tommy Phelps, David Moraga. I'm just reading off the guys that played in the big leagues. Troy Mattis, Jason DeRocher. How do you say the last name? Fernando
Seganol.
Simon Pond, I remember playing for the Blue Jays for a while. Yep. But yeah, Fulmer and Vlad are obviously the big names. That's an incredible amount of talent coming off an A-ball team.
Loaded that year, as it turns out. I mean, Andrew Jones was in Macon. Almost every team had guys that wound up having long major league careers, which you don't see at that level all the time. Fernando Seganol wound up making a ton of money in Japan. Was a great player over there, and now is a scout for the Tokyo Giants. He's a scout for one of the teams in Japan, and I see him around the International League all the time. It's fun to reminisce about that team in 95 now with him.
Yeah, no kidding. So how many more jumps? I mean, we got to bridge the gap about, I think, 8 years between there and getting you to Rochester. So how many more hops?
Yeah, it was just in Albany for the 1 year because the team got sold and moved, and so everybody lost their job. And then I landed in Kinston, North Carolina with the Cleveland Indians affiliate in the Carolina League. I was there for 4 years. And then I went to Binghamton, New York with the Mets affiliate in AA for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of led to here.
So you kind of went up the ladder like a minor league player would.
Yeah, there aren't too many guys actually in broadcasting that have been at every single level like I have at this point through the minor leagues. That is a little bit rare, but I hit pretty much every rung on the way up there.
So how does that change for you? I mean, obviously the caliber of baseball changes. I'm sure AA to AAA is not as much of a leap. Some people say, mm-hmm. You might see more curveballs or the finer points of the game, but some of the superstar players like Joe Mauer jump from AA to the MLB. How is it different for a broadcaster to move levels?
Well, when I first got the job here, I was a little bit nervous from the standpoint of dealing with the players. I didn't know how they would be because I'd heard nightmare stories about how everybody is unhappy in AAA. You know, nobody wants to be here. You've got some older guys who spent a lot of major league time in some cases, so I didn't know how they would be. As it turns out, the players are just pretty much the same as they are anywhere else. And quite frankly, I mean, AAA is the easiest level to broadcast in the minor leagues by far because the players have so much more history behind them, so there's a lot more stuff to talk about. Stuff that happens in the major leagues has a direct impact on what happens here in AAA, so that gives you more stuff to talk about. The ballparks are, by and large, a lot nicer. The broadcast booths are, by and large, nicer. For the most part, you're staying in a lot better hotels when you're on the road. So AAA is much, much easier to broadcast than, say, Class A ball. I mean, it's not even close. So I really kind of feel for those guys. And of course, it's changed a lot over the years too since I started, because when I began, I mean, the internet wasn't around, or if it was, I mean, I certainly didn't know how to access it, and I didn't have a laptop or anything like that. I mean, now I have so much more information available at my fingertips during the broadcast so that I can check on stuff, during an inning break. I never used to be able to do that. I used to cart around this case that had all these different reference books, that I would stash with me in the booth for the broadcast. And if I needed to, you'd try to thumb through there and find something. And, now you don't really need to do that. So there have been a lot of changes in that regard, too.
One thing I really like is they have MLB.tv. They have the minor league version as well. And mm-hmm. so actually I can see the games that you do. And so it's kind of cool from here, if I want to watch Alex Meyer, mm-hmm. not anymore, I guess, or
right.
not as much
anymore.
He had
a tough outing yesterday, too. Too bad.
He really did. I want big things for him.
I do, too.
But at the same time, I feel like he's at an age now where the expectations should be much lower. So I can watch you from here. How much Do you enjoy that, or the idea that now you have a wider audience, or a wider potential audience?
Yeah, I think it's great, absolutely. I mean, before, you know, and everybody can stream the games, whether it's even audio, you know, if you want to listen to it. Yeah, absolutely. Before, you were just limited to the reach of your radio station. For a while there was an outfit called, I think, Teamline, maybe, and you could actually call up an 800 number and pay per minute and listen to games on your phone, which I know some families would do to listen to their sons playing in various minor league stops. But, yeah, it's great. I mean, and it is something that I'm always cognizant of, too. That's fun.
So, obviously, you've reached AAA. What are your career aspirations, or what is your dream job?
Well, I'd love to be a major league announcer for.
I assumed that, but I didn't want to put those words in your mouth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's always the goal. I mean, the longer you're around in AAA, I guess maybe the less of an opportunity you can see on the horizon. But sure, that's still the goal for me, ultimately. But I love broadcasting baseball. I mean, I really do, and it's hard for me to imagine not, or it's hard to me imagine being in a position where I couldn't broadcast AAA baseball games at the very least. I mean, I really do like doing it. I love baseball. I love broadcasting baseball, and so this is a pretty great opportunity to do that.
So, I believe you joined the Red Wings in 2003.
Yeah, it happened to coincide actually with when they first teamed up with the Twins.
Yeah, I think the Twins had been with Salt Lake before that.
They were right before that. They were in Edmonton.
Okay, so it went Toledo,
years.
Toledo, Salt Lake, Edmonton, Rochester, right?
Yes.
Okay, so. Obviously, if you're taking over and covering the Twins, you probably had to kind of learn a lot about the Twins in a mm-hmm. quick time frame, didn't you?
Yeah, the good thing is that when I was in Binghamton the three previous seasons before coming here, they were in the same division in the Eastern League as New Britain, which back then was still the Twins' AA affiliate, so I had seen a lot of those guys.
So you're seeing a lot of, like, Justin Morneau, Jason Kubel, or am I off a little bit?
Justin Morneau, for sure. Kubel had not come through yet.
Sure.
But I had seen Morneau. I had seen Michael Resevich.
Oh, you probably got Kubel at Rochester in 03 then.
In 04.
04, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. He debuted in 04, had the strikeout against Rivera in the playoffs with the pitch at his eyes, and then he tore up his knee, I think is how I remember that going.
Yeah, after that in the Arizona Fall League.
Yeah.
Him and Ryan Rayburn ran into each other.
Oh, I didn't even know it was Rayburn. I had never even, because you know, obviously, coverage of the Fall League was much more diminished back then, too. I mean, now you can watch games on MLB Network. But, you know, I had no idea it was Rayburn.
Yeah, Ryan Rayburn was playing second base.
Wow.
Yeah, and I still think if that injury had never happened, I think Kubel would have been a perennial Major League All-Star. I'm convinced.
Well, he was the third. I mean, he was the third amigo with Maurer and Morneau, right? I mean,
he was a little bit younger, but I mean, he was going to be, and he wound up having a nice career.
Sure,
but he was fast before the knee injury. He could steal bases. You know, he was a tremendous outfielder. That took a little bit of an element away from his game, and it cost him pretty much a full season, I think, didn't it? Anyway, too. So I just think he would have been a much better player than he already was if that had never happened.
So off the radar a little bit, but I'm going to get. I would like your opinion on this. Kyle Schwarber, similar injury. I don't think people realize how good of a hitter Kubel was. Do you think there's any chance a similar thing could happen to Schwarber?
Well, you mean not fulfill his potential?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously a catcher obviously needs their knee as much as well, and you know, he was. Perhaps
I don't know how many people actually honestly think he's going to be a catcher.
True, but he was also kind of ill-equipped to play the outfield too.
Right.
So you know, you might have to be a situation where they trade him to the American League as well.
Yeah, I really don't know. I think in Kubel's case, he was still a good hitter after that.
Right.
It just took some other aspects of his game away. You know, I don't know. Schwarber was never going to steal any bases, really, and like you say, a lot of folks have thought he was more of a DH to begin with. But I don't know. That's a good question. I've not really seen him play a ton. Just what I've seen on TV and in one World Series game I went to last year, but he certainly looks like he can really hit.
So what's the difference between calling like a minor league game and a major league game for you?
Well, I've only called one big league game, I guess. So.
Sure. Sorry, I mean, the difference, I mean, your supposed difference. I mean, with roster fluidity especially, you know, because you've got players coming from separate directions, both up from AA and then down from major leagues. Does it kind of broaden your base in terms of players you have to be aware of?
Oh, maybe a little bit, I guess. I haven't really thought about it. But, yeah, probably I am maybe a little bit more aware of some of the guys that are in lower levels, knowing that they might come up here at any point. And also, if you're with one major league team, presumably from year to year, there won't necessarily be a ton of changes. I mean, some years there might be, but you're going to see a lot of the same guys year in and year out. And while that happens to a certain degree here, there is a lot more of a roster turnover from one season to the next, and certainly at lower levels. I mean, when you're working at Class A or Double A, I mean, a lot of times you might get an entirely new roster. So you do have to be aware of more guys, and it maybe does create a little bit more work in that regard, I guess.
All right. So what would you say is your favorite single memory from being with the Rochester Red Wings?
You know, that's a tough one. We haven't won a championship yet, so I can't say there was a championship moment at the end of the season. The 2006 playoff run was pretty fun, beating Scranton-Wilkes-Barre in the first round and then went all the way to the decisive Game 5 in Toledo. Ultimately, Toledo won that game because the Red Wings kind of ran out of pitching, but that was a really fun playoff series, and the crowds in Toledo were great, and it was really, really a good time. On a personal level, getting a chance to call a Twins game in 2011 in New York against the Yankees was really great. So those are maybe the things that jump out. And in 2005, when Francisco Liriano came through here, I mean, he really took the league by storm, and really minor league baseball by storm that year. And so it was really fun to see him every fifth day, because you could tell that this guy was going to be really, really special at the major league level. So those are some things that that kind of jump out right off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's a natural segue to, who were some of your favorite players to come through? Obviously, Liriano, very gifted, and Nate told me you might mention him. But, you know, for much as flack as the Twins have gotten for their farm system recently, you've obviously seen some very special players.
Yeah, and I mean, some of the guys I might say are favorites aren't necessarily guys that put up the big numbers
sure,
either.
Yeah.
But when I first came here, I mean, Justin Morneau and Michael Restovich were really great dudes that I enjoyed being around a lot. Denard Spann was a fun guy to be around. Tommy Watkins, you know, is a real fan favorite.
Oh, yeah, everywhere he's been. He's the mayor of Fort Myers.
Yeah, just a tremendous guy. Brian Dinkelman was a lot of fun to be around.
Yeah, he got the call up to the Twins.
And recently, two of my favorites have probably been Doug Bernier and Eric Fryer. Just really good veteran-type guys who are really smart baseball players who, you know, if they choose so, I think down the road will be really good coaches or managers. James Beresford, I don't know if I've ever been happier to hear about a guy getting called up to the big leagues than I was for Beresford last year. I mean, those are some names of guys that I really enjoyed being around. A.J. Ochter is another one. A.J. Ochter is a tremendous guy who really pitched well here and fortunately, you know, finally got a chance to pitch in the major leagues and has done okay. And we mentioned Alex Meyer already. I mean, Alex is a guy that you can't help but root for. He's really about as nice a person as you could possibly ever run around. I'm like you. I just hope that eventually he's able to really put everything together and have a nice major league career.
So how about outside the organization? Obviously, you're going to see some Red Sox prospects. You know, they're going to bring guys, Jackie Bradley, all that kind of caliber of players. I mean, who have you seen outside? You know, I don't know if Xander Bogaerts sort of passed through, if he was one of those guys that jumped, but you've obviously seen some gifted players that didn't play in the Twins organization too, I'm sure.
Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, one of the guys that jumped out was Mookie Betts when he came through Pawtucket.
Oh, he's special.
Because, you know, and he was starting to get a lot of attention that year, but I think he started that season in Double A and got bumped up to Pawtucket, and there was just something about the guy. You could just tell watching him play that he loved to play baseball, for one thing, and even though he's a little guy, he hit the ball really hard, and they had just started to play him in the outfield a little bit, but he was still making great catches. I mean, he jumps out as somebody recently that you could just tell was going to be a great player. I think Traitner is another that jumps out that I think is going to be a great player. You know, he spent a lot of time in Syracuse, played a lot of games against Rochester, and really killed the Red Wings on numerous occasions. I think he's going to be really, really good. Those are two names that kind of pop up immediately. You know, Gary Sanchez was in Scranton-Wilkes-Barre the first part of last year, and and you know, was phenomenal and did even better when he got up to the big leagues. But it's really evident the kind of improvement Sanchez has made behind the plate over the last couple of years, too. Those are some names just right off the top of my head that jump out just from the AL North. This league last year had a lot of really good players in it, but those are all some players who have been in the league recently that, you know, in some cases, as in Mookie Betts, have already turned into elite players of the major league level.
Now, that I'm going to harken back to that 2006 Toledo team. I suspect you have seen a ton of Mike Hessman in your day then.
Yeah, a lot. It's funny. He's hit a couple of his record. Well, I guess he's done now, but he hit a couple of his record or milestone home runs against Rochester. He hit his career home run number, I think it was 400, against the Red Wings when playing for Louisville, and that was counting all the home runs he'd hit in pro ball. That was counting minor league, major leagues in Japan. And then he hit his home run that tied the modern minor league record against the Red Wings for Toledo. Hit it off Michael Bowden, the former Boston Red Sox
righty. Former big-time Red Sox prospect.
Two of his milestone home runs have actually come against Rochester. I always thought it would be fun to have him play for the Red Wings at some point because he was a great Triple-A hitter. And I think someone, if he had been in the right situation earlier in his career, he could have played a lot more in the major leagues because he was surprisingly very good defensively, too. And for a guy who's huge, I actually saw him play shortstop a few times, believe it or not. Even in AAA, I saw him play shortstop. He was a really talented baseball player, and he's a guy that I'm sure is going to wind up being a manager at some point. In fact, I think he was a hitting coach last year for the Tigers in A-ball, and I would be shocked if he doesn't at some point wind up being a manager somewhere.
And you see a lot of those, quad A, 4A kind of guys. I mean, what is the vibe around guys like that? Because obviously you can tell they're good enough to play at another level, but that level is somewhere between the big leagues and that level. It's got to be kind of difficult for you to see that too and know that they deserve more than where they're at.
Yeah, I think it probably just depends on the guy and how they approach it. I think in Hessman's case, you know, he had played at least in the major leagues some, and if he was bitter about it at all, he certainly did not seem that way whatsoever. I heard nothing but good stuff about him as a guy in the clubhouse, and he was someone his teammates really looked up to a lot. On the Red Wings level, a guy that I thought might kind of end up in that sort of situation, unfortunately, was Garrett Jones for a while. I mean, Garrett put up some big-time power numbers here, and never got a great opportunity to play in the big leagues with Minnesota. And then fortunately, in another organization, he did get that chance, and he kind of ran with it, you know. And he's done okay for himself, and he's playing in Japan now, making some money. But Garrett's a guy that, you know, it looked like at one point might get stuck in that sort of situation too.
Well, one thing that made me laugh about him was he was blocked by Morneau here, went to Pittsburgh. Then Pittsburgh traded for Morneau so that he could play over Garrett Jones. And then Garrett Jones, I think, went to the Marlins. And then when Morneau was a free agent before he signed with the Rockies, I think the Marlins were talking to him as well. And it was just one of those deals where Garrett Jones couldn't get away from Justin Morneau.
Away from him. At least, you know, with the Pirates, at least he finally got a chance to play some
and
hit a few home runs and then played some for the Yankees. And he's done okay for himself, which is Garrett's a really good guy and just tremendous power at the plate. I mean, it was always evident when you saw him play that this guy had as much power as anyone, and you just kind of got the feeling that if somebody would give him an opportunity to get some consistent at-bats at the major league level, maybe he'll be able to stick, and finally that kind of happened for him.
So a player cut from a similar cloth as Hessman, Matt Hagg, you'll probably get a chance to see a fair amount of this year, barring something unusual. Same kind of deal with him, I suspect. What do you know about him?
I don't know a lot about him yet. I will say this, too. I think he is a good example of someone that if he had been in a different organization maybe where he had a chance to get some consistent at-bats in the major leagues, he may have had a 3 or 4 year major league career by now because he can hit. I've seen enough of him to know that. Now, I don't think he has a ton of power, but a lot of line drive power. He's going to hit a lot of doubles. He's the only player in the history of the International League to lead this league in hits 3 different seasons. And he can play okay at first and third base. I mean, I just think he's a good baseball player. But I'm anxious to see him. And if he's here, which I assume he probably will be, I would anticipate he's going to be one of the best players in the International League again. I mean, 2 years ago he put up just incredible numbers with Buffalo.
He's an MVP,
when
he
won the IL MVP award, and then last year was in Japan. But I think he'll be a really good player for Rochester for whatever length of time he is here, if in fact he does wind up in the Flower City, as they call it.
So you mentioned, we call him James Bierfeld. I heard he's Jim with you guys, or Jimmy, isn't he?
I always called him James.
Okay, I always thought he was James too, but I've heard people call him Jim or Jimmy. It's
James.
So you obviously were surprised, or not surprised, rather excited that he got called to big leagues last year. Probably a year too late, but more of a product of where the Twins were, where it was kind of a flip-flop thing. Currently unsigned, as far as I know right now. But you know, what was it like having him in the organization? Obviously, I think he was, they believed, the first player to ever play 1,000 games in the Twins minor league system. Obviously, a guy that could
really
do a little.
I had not heard that. Which makes sense now that you say that.
Yeah, Dustin Morse was trying to nail that down, but obviously he had that funny shirt with the kangaroo with the wet newspaper and the, what was it, I think 4 stars for all the home runs he'd hit, and obviously just a guy who was he seemed to be a good, not only clubhouse guy, but he could obviously play. You know, what can you say about a guy that could do a little bit of everything for that team for a long time?
Yeah, he's just a great guy. I mean, I don't know if I've, you know, I've been here for a while, but I don't know if I could ever come up with a player who is probably more well-liked by his teammates than him. I mean, just everybody loves the guy. He's a guy that can make fun of himself, make fun of others, just always in a terrific mood and just always ready to play day in and day out. Just a terrific player. I mean, he was a really good player here for a long time. And like you said, 2 years ago, he played tremendously. I mean, he was second in the league in hitting behind only Matt Haig 2 years ago. Really probably deserved a call up that season, and is really good defensively too with what he gets to. Now, he doesn't have maybe the optimum range of some guys, which might be, you know, the one thing I would say that probably has kept him from having a major league career at this point is that he's not real fast.
Yeah.
You know, that might be the one thing. He's not a base stealer, and since he doesn't have any power, you'd probably like some more speed from a guy like that, but that's probably about the only real negative you could come up with for his game for that type of a guy.
Now, Nate told me I got to ask you about Stan and Stu Clyburn. He said that they're pretty unique characters. Obviously, manager and was a pitching coach at the time, and now
Stu's still a pitching coach.
Yeah, Stu came back. He was gone and then came back, but he said that you probably had some stories about those guys.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't say very many of them on this podcast.
Classic. That's how it goes with baseball. It's one of those deals where you've got the stories that are you know, air appropriate, and then the ones that you might share in the clubhouse.
Yeah, those are two guys too. They were in New Britain when I was in Binghamton, so I got the job in Rochester, and I was here for, let's see, it must have been 3 years, and then in 06 they got promoted back up here, so I was around them again. After not been, but I had seen them in spring training too. But just, you know, they're twin brothers. They've got stories from one end of the ballpark to the other, some of which are even true. And they are unique characters, to say the least. I'd say they're one of a kind, except there's two of them, which is the crazy thing about it, you know. But it's great to have Stu around, and he knows his pitching, too. I mean, Stu's a good pitching coach. I've always thought that Stu would be a terrific major league bullpen coach, maybe, because I just think a major league team, when you've got the stress of a major league schedule, things are very serious, all that, having Stu around as kind of comic relief would probably be a great fit, I think, for a major league bullpen. I just think you'd be great in a major league bullpen coach sort of situation if you ever got that chance.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Eddie Gordado's role with the Twins, obviously, comedic relief.
And Stu was a pretty good major league pitcher. I mean, Stan caught part of one season with the Angels, but Stu was a pretty good major league pitcher for a couple of years. And I discovered last year, I didn't know this before, I feel that I should have, but he mentioned to me last year that he actually made his major league debut in the game in which Reggie Jackson hit his 500th career home run.
Oh, wow.
And I was able to go back and check, and actually that was true. And as Stu told the story, he was warming up, getting ready to come into the game, and in the Angels' offensive half of the inning, Reggie Jackson hit his 500th career home run. So Stu comes out the next inning to warm up, Major League debut, and Bob Boone comes out to the mound, the catcher. He's like, "Hey, Stu, you got to wait a minute." And Gene Autry, who was the owner of the Angels, came out on the field during the game with a microphone and made some sort of presentation to Reggie Jackson and Reggie Jackson made some speech right on the field about his 500th home run. So Stu is out there waiting on the pitcher's mound to make his major league debut and didn't know what to do with himself.
That's incredible.
So he finally got a chance to make his debut after Reggie finished his speech.
Oh, man, imagine how the butterflies got to multiply when you're standing on the mound and
yeah.
that's all going on. What's the latest you've heard on Mike Quadi? I guess I got to ask, too. You know, obviously, yeah. Nate said he's a really great guy to have around. It's got to be kind of a luxury for a team to have a former big league manager as their AAA manager. But also, too, you know, he was in that car accident recently. I think I heard he was having shoulder surgery here in the Twin Cities pretty soon. What's the latest you've heard, and what's he like?
Yeah, I don't know anything more than you probably about the accident thing, which is pretty scary. I mean, they could have been hurt bad.
Right.
And like you say, I think I read that Sunday, as in a couple of days ago, he had shoulder surgery, which means he won't be able to throw batting practice this season, which minor league managers generally do. And Mike, it's always been my impression, really liked throwing batting practice. I mean, that was almost part of his workout routine. You know, he treats batting practice very serious for himself as a way to keep in shape. And for a guy his age, he's in great shape. And so I don't know what we're going to do this year necessarily without him able to throw batting practice. And Chad Allen, the hitting coach, is kind of a shoulder also. Stu Clyburn, you know, as we just talked, Stu has some issues also, so he doesn't always throw batting practice. So I don't know if they're maybe going to add a coach here for Rochester or what they're going to do. Because I think, even though it sounds like a little thing, I think they're probably worried right now about what they're going to do to cover up all the batting practice pitches that need to be thrown this year.
Well,
but as far as Q specifically as a manager, I really do think he does a great job. I mean, he's an excellent third base coach. He's been a major league third base coach. He really knows what he's doing over there. Just a really sharp guy who I think probably pays more attention to a lot of the numbers and those sorts of things than a lot of his fellow AAA managers do. Now, you know, at this level, you don't have the luxury of getting as much information as a major league manager would, but the info as far as, you know, lefty righty splits and things like that Q is able to get, he really factors all that into how he makes his decisions, and I think that probably benefits the Red Wings a lot on the field in terms of wins and losses, because I don't necessarily think that all of his counterparts in this league do the same thing and put in the same amount of preparation that he does.
So you actually gave me a natural segue about the throwing batting practice. You know, obviously with minor leagues, guys have to wear different hats. I know the mm-hmm. assistant GM for the Saints will take tickets sometimes. And so maybe yours would be throwing batting practice and then hustling up to the broadcast booth to do your job. But do you wear any different hats for the Wings, or are you pretty strictly? Like, I know Bryce Zimmerman used to broadcast the games, and then he would write a game story to send out to the media. You know, is it pretty strictly broadcasting for you, or do you do other things as well for the team?
Well, I help with the sales effort here as far as advertising and tickets go. I assist Nate with some of the PR stuff, but we're fortunate here that we've always had a good PR guy to help out with that sort of thing. So for the most part, I'm able to focus during the season primarily on just the broadcast part of my job, which is very good. I mean, not everybody in my shoes in this league can say that, so I feel very fortunate that I have the opportunity to do that, because it makes a difference. I mean, if I had to spend all day coming up with media notes and that sort of thing, it would take away from the preparation I was doing for the broadcast that night. So I'm really happy that I do have the job description that I do.
So you recently called your 2000th game honored on the field. What was that like?
Well, I guess it was 2000 Red Wings games, something like that.
Yeah.
I didn't really know that I was approaching 2000 at the time. I knew it was a big number, but I've been here for a long time. So, but yeah, you know, I've done this now, let's see, 95. So I've done it 22 years so far. And in 22 years of broadcasting minor league baseball, I've only missed one game.
Wow.
And that was a few years ago for a friend of mine's wedding. Here in Rochester. So in 22 years of doing it, you can do the math, you know, roughly 140 games a year times 22. I've only missed one game. So I've missed a lot of things I probably should have missed games for, but that's just kind of how I've approached the job.
Yeah, Nate was telling me you could probably count on one hand how many games you had missed. So he was
It's one.
Wow,
so I'd have fingers left over.
Yeah, you would. So you got to call, I was told, Mariano Rivera's record-setting save against the Twins.
Yeah, the game when he broke the all-time save record, I did that game with John Gordon in New York. That was in 2011.
Must have been quite a thrill.
Yeah, Chris Parmalee made the final out. But that was fun, and I knew I was going to do the game. It was a makeup game. The Twins had a game rained out in New York early that season. In fact, it was, you'll remember that series, I bet, because it was the series when Nishioka broke his leg.
Oh yeah, it would have been like the second week of the season or something.
It was right at the start of the season.
Swisher slid into
out,
him. Yeah,
and they made it up on an off day in September, and so instead of having Gladden fly in for that game with the Twins, because nobody wanted to be there from the Twins' perspective. You know, you're just flying in for one game and leaving, basically.
Plus, it was their first really awful year, too.
Yeah, it was a bad year. And then by that point in September, I mean, probably more than half the guys in the lineup were guys who'd played in Rochester.
It was like Joe Benson and Brian Dinkelman and
Steve Holm. Well, and actually,
Steve
that's a good point, because Parmalee and Benson had not played in Rochester. They skipped Rochester.
That's right. Yeah, they got sent. And then Benson had been sent back to like A-ball for a while, too, I know.
Yeah, that was that season.
Yeah, the Hammett bone was bad for him, and that kind of derailed his career, too, I think.
Yep.
But
Scott Diamond started the game on the mound. He had been in Rochester, obviously.
Crazy.
But I knew I was doing the game, you know, probably a month or two ahead of time. And in looking at the schedule, I knew there was a chance that, hey, you know, but by that point, Rivera could be closing in on the all-time save record. That'd be pretty cool if it was that day. And sure enough, that's how it worked out. And, yeah, it was pretty cool.
So one of your fellow broadcasters, I have to ask, this is a big wrestling fan. It's Tony Schiavone. And I asked you off the air if you knew him well or knew of him well. And obviously, you do as well. But any fun stories about him or anything interesting about working near him?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, Gwinnett, the team that he broadcasts for, which is suburban Atlanta, they're in another division, and so we only play them two series a year, because I would love to be around the guy more often. Now, when Tony got hired there, I didn't know who he was, because I'm not a wrestling fan, but I've come to discover just how big of a name he is. I mean, you know, people will, when Gwinnett is in Rochester, people will wait and get his autograph after games outside here.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
Or want to come into the press box and get their picture taken with him here. And it's crazy. He's just a fun, funny guy. He's got a great outlook on life. He loves to eat at the various tremendous old school Italian restaurants that they have in Rochester, and there are a lot of them. So, you know, somebody on our staff always takes him to this little Italian restaurant that's been around since the 40s, that's about two blocks away from our ballpark, and he, you know, he always makes sure to get the tripe over there. And if you don't know what tripe is,
I think it's not something
I'm going to be ordering anytime soon. Maybe you will be, but yeah, he's just a great guy and really, really fun to be around.
Okay, so if you could work for any Twins affiliate, and we're not stepping on any toes here, this is purely hypothetical. I know you love what you do in Rochester, but if you could work at any of the affiliates, and you know, maybe it's weather, maybe it's location, which would you choose? Because obviously Chattanooga wasn't a Twins affiliate when you started. You know, it was New Britain, so very similar. Obviously Fort Myers is in the mix. Where would you want to work as part of a Twins affiliate if you could?
Well, geographically, Cedar Rapids would work out for me.
Sure.
Being from Kansas, although I don't have a ton of relatives left there anymore, I would hedge my bet here and say the first half of the season in Chattanooga, when the weather's better down there.
Sure.
And then the second half of the season in Rochester when the weather's better up here.
That's a pretty diplomatic answer. I can respect that. So what are your expectations for this 2017 Wings team? Obviously, there's been some talent that has come through there. They'll also have some older guys that will obviously not make the club, or you know, maybe someone like Trevor May comes down to lengthen out a little bit before getting a chance in the rotation. Maybe you get a look at Ryan Vogelsong. Obviously, you have to prepare for probably 35, 40 different guys. But yeah, what are your expectations for the team this year?
Yeah, well, I don't know, because you know, I recently wrote a few blog posts just trying to come up with the potential names that might be here this season. And I think looking at just for starting pitchers alone, you can come up with like 18, 19 guys
right.
that could possibly be here.
Yeah.
So it's really tough to tell. I'll say this. I think the team has a chance probably to be pretty good. You know, last year they won 81 games and yet did not make the playoffs. And they were one of only a handful of 80-win teams in the history of the International League not to make the playoffs, but two teams in the Red Wings division, Scranton-Wilkes-Barre and Lehigh Valley, won more games. It was crazy. But I would anticipate the team is going to be pretty good again. I mean, you know, whoever misses out on that fifth starter spot, I would say there's a chance could wind up here. You know, even a Jose Berríos maybe, mm-hmm. and if he's here, I would certainly anticipate that he would dominate again at this level. So, I would think maybe a couple of those veteran pitchers that they signed, like a Nick Tepish or a Drew Rosinski, could be here, and they would probably be pretty good.
Yeah, we had Drew on the show about a month and a half ago. He was real good.
Yeah, you know what? I've been meaning to listen to that podcast, come to think of it.
One of our highest listened ones somehow. I don't know how, but it's yeah, obviously
Drew. But, you know, and I'm sure he's chomping at the bit to pitch in the International League compared to the PCL.
Oh, yeah. Way better pitching atmosphere.
Because, you know, you look at his numbers at other leagues, and they're pretty good. And then I know he struggled in the PCL, but, you know, I have to think that he's going to do better in this league. I think the bullpen will probably be pretty good. Like I said, Matt Hague, if he's here, I think would be one of the better hitters in the league. I think catching should be a position of strength.
Yeah, you have Mitch Garver probably.
If Garver's here,
maybe Murphy too.
Super impressed with Garver at the end of last season. I'm anxious to see Zach Granite in the outfield. I think, you know, if you look at it, at this point, it's tough to tell, but it's difficult for me to imagine that the team won't be pretty good. But who knows? I mean, things can change so quickly with a minor league team at this level, depending on injuries and how the major league team is doing. I mean, things can change very, very quickly. But I would guess the team will be pretty good. We'll just have to wait and see how it pans out, I guess.
Well, obviously, John Ryan Murphy had a tough year offensively last mm-hmm. year, but the numbers defensively, you look at Baseball Perspective, say he was a good pitch receiver and all that.
Yeah.
Did you see a lot from him defensively to back up these numbers? Like, was he a good defensive pitcher?
You know, I'm still somewhat skeptical on these framing stats.
Sure, that makes sense.
I'd love to know how they figure some of this, because there seem to be so many variables that I don't know how you could possibly calculate whether a guy is really great framing something or not. But I know what you're talking about. I mean, Baseball Prospectus had John Ryan Murphy as, I think, the best framing catcher in all of minor league baseball last year.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The pitchers loved pitching to him. And I don't have the number off the top of my head, but the team's record when he started behind the plate was really, really good. And so I have to think that some of that had to do with his ability to call games, his ability to frame pitches. I know our pitchers raved about how good he was at calling a game. So, and aside from his raw offensive numbers, you know, his batting average and his power numbers were not good, but he came through in clutch situations left and right last year. I think he had the best batting average with runners in scoring position of any player on the team, oddly enough. So he got a bunch of hits in spots that mattered. So it's difficult to argue with the raw win-loss numbers when he was behind the plate. I mean, the team did well when he started behind the plate. So, he must have been doing something right, I think. And for me, if I'm the Twins, that's a tough call as far as who's going to be that backup to Jason Castro. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see who winds up getting that. And again, whoever winds up here in Rochester behind the plate, I think the Red Wings are going to be in a pretty good catching situation.
Yeah, my gut says it's going to be Chris Giménez just based on his pedigree.
You mean getting the Twins job?
Yeah, just based on he's obviously got ties to Levine and Falvey. I think they want to go with what they would call mentally capable veterans, guys that mm-hmm. will prop other people up. Vogelsong, Belial, Giménez, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right.
Giménez.
I think Giménez
crushes lefties.
Yeah, so that helps too. And that's what Murphy you would expect to do as well, which is something Castro doesn't do. So you do want to have someone that can support what your other catcher doesn't do, which I think makes sense.
Yeah, and like I said, with Garver, he was only here for, what, 25 games or something like that?
I think
it
was 22, yep.
I was really impressed. I thought and I've been a little bit surprised with some of the different prospect rankings that have him, I don't know, 15, 20 in the Twins organization, because the way I look at it, to me, and I know that the shocking thing is here too, Brandon, he's actually older than John Ryan Murphy.
Yeah, I did. I've tweeted that. Yeah, it is funny.
Yeah, he is a little bit older than John Ryan Murphy, which is not something that you should overlook. But I think Garver has a chance to be a regular major league catcher. And if a guy is going to be a regular everyday major league catcher, isn't he probably better than your 15th best prospect in the organization?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they're adjusting for context there. It's right. more, oh, you know yeah, I mean? This A-ball guy throws 100. Well, does he strike anybody out? Does he have yeah. moxie? You know, it's not adjusted for what a big league team needs. It's just from a distance.
Yeah, and if you just, and this is a bad way to look at it, I know, but if you just watch Garver play, you just get this, and somebody else mentioned this to me too, you just get the vibe that that guy's a major league player. I know there's almost nothing you can put a finger on it necessarily, but when you watch him play, you just have the feeling that guy looks like a major league player, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you and I met briefly, and I'm not sure if you'd remember it, but in the Twins...
At Target Field,
yeah,
I think, right?
In the Twins dugout, and I just kind of introduced myself.
Oh, okay.
I was marginally aware of you from your work, and I'm sure, obviously, you were even less so of me. But what goes into a guy like you getting a September call-up like that, quote-unquote?
I don't know. I think in the case in 2011, you know, I was nearby, and I think that was just a way to, you know, give me a pat on the back.
An attaboy?
Yeah, kind of, you know, I think that's what it was.
Because you weren't on the 40-man roster. I know that the year you came up would have been like 2013,
yeah, absolutely.
2014.
I'd spent more time than a lot of those guys that got called up for the team. I don't know. I mean, if I knew the answer as to what I needed to do to get a major league job, I think I'd already have one right now. But
true.
I think a lot of it's timing, and a lot of it's being in the right place at the right time, and a lot of it's luck, and you have to do a good job too. And I think it's kind of, you know, it's kind of expected these days. A lot of people put down young play-by-play guys, I think, and everybody talks about how terrific play-by-play announcers were way back when. But I think there are a lot of really good broadcasters right now, and it's just tough. There's a ton of competition mm-hmm. for these jobs that don't open up very often. So you've just got to cross your fingers and hope for the best.
Yeah, it's one of those jobs where it's competitive and the people at the top don't want to leave.
Yeah, why would they?
Yeah, right. So I'll leave you with this. The Big 12 tournament opens tomorrow.
Okay.
Kansas plays on Thursday. They are the number one seed. What is your expectation for this Big 12 tournament and for Kansas's prospects at maybe landing a number one seed in the big dance or something like that?
Well, I'm very confident they're going to be a number one seed.
Sure.
I don't know if they'll be the number one overall seed. That might be determined on how they do in Kansas City. But, you know, hopefully they'll do well. I'm always cautiously, very cautiously optimistic every year in the NCAA tournament with them. You know, I would like to think they have a really good chance to get at least to the Final Four, but who knows? I just hope they don't flame out the first weekend. But I'll have my – I mean, I'm not a very calm fan when it comes to watching KU basketball. I find those to be very stressful games to watch. So,
I'm sure.
You know, I just am a basket case for the two and a half hours of every KU basketball game, especially in the tournament. And to a certain degree, I'll really be ready for it to be over when baseball season starts, so I don't have to deal with the stress of those games anymore.
Well, thanks for coming on with us. We really appreciate having you on.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
He's Josh Wetzel. I'm Brandon Warren. Tom Schreier is also here. You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.